This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. South Korea is designating several southeastern provinces hard hit by COVID-19 as special disaster zones. This makes them eligible for financial support and relief. The designation is usually reserved for areas affected by typhoons, floods, and other national disasters. South Korea has over 8,000 coronavirus cases. Australia says all international travelers to the country will have to self-isolate for 14 days, and no cruise ships from foreign ports will be allowed to dock. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the actions are aimed at stopping the spread of COVID-19.
We know that the virus cannot be absolutely stopped. Of course not. No one can do that. But we can slow the spread. And we anticipate that will be what our task will be over about the next 6 months. No one can know for certain how long this will run. It could be shorter than that. It could be longer than that. But the measures that we're putting in place as a government is making those types of assumptions, but that is being updated on a daily basis.
Appearing on ABC's This Week, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director Dr. Anthony Fauci says China's experience is a useful gauge for estimating the duration and severity of the outbreak.
China really dramatically did what we call social distancing. They just shut down the country. As they start getting back to normal personal interaction, I hope we don't see the second blip, but it's possible.
France has also announced new restrictions to contain the virus. Officials have already closed major tourist attractions, the Eiffel Tower and the Louvre. But starting today, most other places where people gather, restaurants, cinemas, non-essential retail, will be closed as well. For more on the coronavirus, please visit us at voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. French voters went to the polls today to cast their votes in municipal elections, despite an outbreak of the coronavirus. President Emmanuel Macron has insisted that the democratic continuity of the nation would be in jeopardy if the vote was delayed. The Vatican has taken an unprecedented decision due to the coronavirus outbreak. All Holy Week services with Pope Francis will be held without a congregation, including Easter Sunday Mass. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
It will be a very different Holy Week for the faithful this year, particularly for those in Rome. No one will be able to attend any of the services due to the coronavirus outbreak. The large crowds in St. Peter's Square will not be possible this year. A note on the website of the Prefecture of the Pontifical Household that appeared late Saturday said the faithful will be able to follow the events as they are streamed on the internet or carried on television, but no one will be able to actively participate. Holy Week is normally one of the busiest times of the year for Pope Francis, with tens of thousands of people arriving from all over the world to join in celebrating the resurrection of Jesus. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News.
Russia and Turkey cut short their first joint patrol in Syria's Idlib province on Sunday after rebels and civilians opposed to a ceasefire agreement cut off a main roadway to block its path. The patrol on the M4 highway in Idlib was the result of a March 5th ceasefire accord between Moscow and Ankara, which back opposing sides in Syria's 9-year war. The ceasefire has largely held since then. Nigeria's emergency services say an explosion on Sunday killed at least 15 people and destroyed about 50 buildings after a fire broke out in a suburb of Lagos. This man witnessed the explosion.
Some houses collapsed, even the roofs, everywhere collapsed. And some people died, even the school here, people died. Yes, people died.
Several people were injured and taken to a hospital. The exact cause of the explosion is not yet known. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says his country continues to prepare to host the Olympic Games in Tokyo this summer. Reuters' Soraya Ali has more.
The announcement comes as countries around the world shut borders and cancelled public gatherings. The Tokyo 2020 torchlighting ceremony in ancient Olympia was already held without spectators. But Abe and his government have been adamant that the Olympics will go ahead. Speculations about a delay to the event, which is supposed to start in July, has grown since US President Donald Trump said organizers should consider a one-year postponement. Abe and Trump held a call after those comments, but the Japanese premier said they had not discussed a possible delay.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
It has been a surprise. One could have expected more time and possibly a process within the party to choose the one who would be representing the party. But at the same time, Prime Minister Bon Koulibaly is known to be extremely close to the president, and everyone was guessing that it would be the choice of President Ouattara.
Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara endorses his successor ahead of the upcoming October polls.
The 270,000 South Sudanese that have returned in the past couple of years or more, majority of them have not been able to return back home. And in many areas, access still remains a challenge in terms of the humanitarian work.
The UN Refugee Agency and partners are appealing for $1.3 billion to assist South Sudanese refugees.
You know, he wanted to be able to communicate in this way. We're certainly hoping that he'll be able to give us, or at least share, some of the proof of these extremely serious allegations, of which, of course, everybody wants to get to the bottom of.
And a spokesperson for the African Union chairperson, Moussa Faki Mahamat, rejects allegations that the organization is run like a mafia-style cartel. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Ivory Coast, President Alassane Ouattara has endorsed Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly to succeed him. This after the ruling party chose Coulibaly as the presidential candidate in the upcoming October general election. The opposition parties are yet to choose their respective candidates. But they expressed concern the mixed messages from the president were clear indications he wanted to amend the constitution to enable him seek additional terms in office, an accusation officials reject. For analysis on the decision to endorse the ruling party's presidential candidate, I reach Gile Yabi in the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan.
Well, I think the choice that has been made, the choice of Amadou Gon Coulibaly, the current prime minister, is not a surprise. Maybe the way it has been done so quickly after the announcement that President Ouattara himself is not running again, I think that might have been a surprise. One could have expected more time and possibly a process within the party to choose the one who would be representing the party. But at the same time, Prime Minister Bon Koulibaly is known to be extremely close to the president, and everyone was guessing that it would be the choice of President Ouattara.
But do you think he has what it takes to win the election, looking at how fierce and contested the political situation is in Ivory Coast?
Well, it's always difficult to know if someone has what is needed to be a president. What is clear is that the advantage of the outgoing president will now go to Prime Minister Gon Coulibaly. What is important to understand is that the party is very dominant on the political scene and also has quite a large control of the political institutions. There are suspicions that the Electoral Commission itself is more in favor of President Ouattara's party. So, and of course, you have to add also the financial resources that will be at the disposal of the candidate of a ruling party. So when you take all these in consideration, it is actually the fact that he is the candidate of the party that will count and not necessarily the personality of Gon Coulibaly. It is true that a lot of people think that he doesn't have a lot of political clout and that his personality is not very convincing. But at the same time, he's someone who has been in the system for a while, who has been minister at different times, and who, again, has a full confidence and full trust from President Ouattara.
Well, Mr. Yabi, some Ivorians I spoke with said that it appears that President Ouattara chose him and his confirmation was so quick that perhaps he wants to put him there so he can control things from behind the scene. What is your take on that? Do you think the assessment is justified?
Well, yeah, to a large extent, a president who decided not to run again and who has given before a lot of signs that he wanted to stay, I think it means that President Ouattara would like to be still influencing in the country, and he, of course, needs to be protected as well. Otherwise, the country which experiences a lot of political troubles and political violence, and it is clear that President Ouattara and his inner circle and a lot of people who are around him might also be afraid of possible negative consequences after the presidential election. So yes, they definitely would like to have someone that they can trust. And Gon Coulibaly is again probably the closest person to President Ouattara. And so yes, I think that President Ouattara will do everything to make sure that basically he chooses who his successor will be.
Mr. Coulibaly has been in government, as you said, for a long time. He is now the current prime minister, although the presidential candidate for the ruling party. Does he have the charisma and does he have what it takes to unite the country as we speak?
Again, the perception in Cote d'Ivoire is not generally very good regarding Gon Coulibaly himself, because he's been seen more as a technocrat, someone who is politically active, but not someone who connects a lot to the people. But again, at the same time, some people you will discover them when they get to a more visible political status. And I think that probably President Ouattara and the party will now try to accompany Gon Coulibaly to change the image that he has in the country, which again is not very positive. But again, the financial resources, administration, the support of all political actors around President Ouattara, that are a lot of advantage that will be essential for Gon Coulibaly. And the other thing is that when you go to the presidential election, of course, it also depends on what will be the political adversary. And we are in a context where it's not clear that we will have someone very strong also as the opposition leader contesting for the presidential election. So that could also favor Gon Coulibaly.
So what do you think will be the expectations of Ivorians looking at this latest announcement from the outgoing president, Alassane Ouattara?
I think the Ivorians, first of all, were satisfied and relieved to some extent by the decision of President Ouattara to renounce a third mandate that could have been contested on illegal grounds. And I think that they do want political change in the change of generation. I think that they want to see new political actors. It is not clear that Gon Coulibaly would qualify for a new generation, but in the meaning of President Ouattara, Gon Coulibaly, who has now is more than 50, is still young as compared to Ouattara himself and as compared to former President Conan Bédié, who could be the candidate of the PDCI's party. So basically, I think that Ivorian would probably expect a real political competition, and we would probably wait now to know who will be the other candidate, especially from the PDCI's party.
Gile Yabi is a political analyst. He spoke with me from Abidjan. The UN Refugee Agency and partners are appealing for $1.3 billion to assist more than 2 million South Sudanese refugees and five major countries hosting them: Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
After 7 years of conflict, South Sudan has formed a transitional government of national unity and appears to be on the cusp of peace. But the new government faces many challenges. One of the biggest is finding solutions for millions of South Sudanese who have been forcibly displaced by years of conflict, both internally and as refugees. In the meantime, the UN Refugee Agency says some 2.2 million refugees and the countries hosting them continue to depend upon international support to provide them with life-saving assistance. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balash tells VOA, many thousands of refugees who have returned to South Sudan under their own initiative are stuck in limbo in their home country. He says most of those who remain outside the country are in no rush to return. They are waiting to see if peace holds.
The 270,000 South Sudanese that have returned in the past couple of years or more, majority of them have not been able to return back home. We are talking a big number, probably 70% or more. And in many areas, access still remains a challenge in terms of the humanitarian work.
Baller says humanitarian workers and the South Sudanese displaced are hoping that the new political developments translate into long-lasting peace. In the meantime, the UNHCR says funding is urgently needed to provide emergency care for the refugees, including food, shelter, safe drinking water, and health care. It notes money is also needed to care for 65,000 unaccompanied children and action on sexual and gender-based violence. The agency says many refugees are missing out on education and the gap must be closed. It says refugees must be trained in the skills they need to provide for themselves and their families. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A spokesperson for African Union chairperson Musa Faki Mahamat has rejected allegations that the organization is run like a mafia-style cartel. A leaked internal memo from an AU staff used that term in accusing their boss of corruption and cronyism. For VOA, Simon Marks reports from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
The African Union has strongly denied allegations that its head, Chadian politician Musa Faki, has been presiding over a corrupt recruitment process. The allegations, which appeared in a widely circulated staff memo dated March the 6th, were first reported in South Africa's Mail and Guardian. VOA has since obtained a copy of the document, which was signed by Sabelo Mobokazi, the president of the AU Staff Association. The memo gives several examples of allegedly illegal appointments of staff and calls for the, quote, restoration of sound administrative management and leadership. At a meeting on September the 28th, staff complained about the recruitment process for the AU's new head of human resources, Hamza Sahel. Staffers said his hiring was the manifestation of glaring cronyism and total collapse of leadership inside the AU. But Ebba Kalando, the chief spokesperson for Faki, said the AU chairman and the new human resources chief have no direct relationship. She encouraged Sabelo to come forward and substantiate his allegations.
They're obviously very serious allegations. Mr. Sabelo, you know, could have... It's regrettable, of course, that he decided that he wanted to speak to the entire staff complement about this when he has direct access to the chairperson to be able to make these allegations. But seeing that he wanted to make this, you know, he wanted to be able to communicate in this way, we're certainly hoping that he'll be able to give us or at least share some of the proof of these extremely serious allegations, of which, of course, everybody wants to get to the bottom of.
The allegations come during a period when many staff inside the AU are threatened with losing their jobs as the institution goes through deep structural reforms started under the Rwandan presidency in 2018. Faki is currently in Brazzaville, Republic of Congo, to hold talks with African heads of state over the ongoing crisis in Libya. A spokeswoman said when Faki returns, he will respond to Sabelo internally about each point raised in the memo. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The Sudan's health ministry is reporting the country's first coronavirus death. The ministry says a 52-year-old man who had traveled from the United Arab Emirates died on Thursday. Naba Mohideen reports on the Sudanese government's efforts to contain the virus from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
Sudan's health minister is urging people to take measures to stop the spread of coronavirus, such as frequently washing their hands with soap and to notify authorities if they see any suspected cases. The government has announced travel restrictions. Bus service to and from Egypt has been stopped, and authorities have suspended all flights to countries affected by coronavirus. Mohammed Al Mahdi is the Khartoum Airport's director of information. He said Sudan has suspended the flights to 8 countries affected by coronavirus, and airport administration has issued a decision to receive only one flight from foreign countries coming to Khartoum. The decision includes flying to and from Egypt. We stop all flights in the current situation. The decision on flights left hundreds of travelers stranded at airports with nowhere to go. Rashid Umar is one of the travelers who was stuck at the Khartoum airport Friday. Umar was going to Egypt to pick up goods for his business. Umar says they were surprised by the decision of cancelling all flights to and from Egypt. Most of the travelers are traders bringing goods from Egypt to Sudan. This decision affects them, and they don't know what to do and when the flights will be back. Sudan imports many items from both Egypt and China, and the flight ban may increase scarcity in Sudanese markets and drive up prices. Health Minister Akram Atom says his ministry is demanding funds from Sudan's ruling body, the Sovereign Council, to properly combat the virus. Atom says his office submitted recommendations to stringently watch the crossing, to extend shelters for housing and isolation, and also funds should be obtained not only for health sector in Khartoum, but also in different states, so we can distribute enough qualified staff. Dr. Muhammad Abdullah welcomes the preparation, but fears the coronavirus will overwhelm Sudan's health care system. Abdullah says this is a very good procedure, as Sudan's declining health system doesn't bear any kind of disease, whether speaking of the facilities, trained and qualified staff, or preparations to defeat the disease. It's a bit late decision, but at least it's important to decrease the possible cases. Over 140 Sudanese students who were stuck in China's Wuhan province have been evacuated to United Arab Emirates to be monitored for several weeks before they can come back to Sudan. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Rice is the staple food for the Gambians 2 million people. Official figures say every Gambian consumes an average of 117 kilograms per year, more than double the world average. Yet 80% of rice consumed in the West African country is imported. But one man has decided to quit his $85,000 engineering job in the U.S. to return home to the Gambia to farm rice to feed his community and promote food self-sufficiency for his country. VOA Sharif Bojang Jr. has the details from the Gambian capital, Banjul.
On a vast wet farm in Gambia's Central River region, Musa Dabo and his staff transplant rice seedlings. Born and raised in Bansang, some 316 kilometers from Banjul, Musa's father was a successful rice farmer. As a kid, he spent all his days in the field.
My childhood was filled with long and tedious days in the rice fields. From school, we have to go to the rice field where we have our lunch. Then we work until probably dusk. Then we come home. And we never had the chance to go around and play like the other kids.
Musa's father was the wealthiest farmer and owner of farming tools used by his community of thousands of people. Rice was his family's income source. Rice money paid school fees for Musa, his siblings, and other extended relatives. In April 2000, Musa left for the U.S. for greener pastures. The family continued to grow rice, generating more income and saving enough rice for consumption. In 2009, his father died, and for the next couple of years, the family struggled to keep his legacy alive. First, the farming machines, including tractors, broke down, and then other problems followed. However, there was still enough rice for consumption. In 2012, Musa received what he considered as a bizarre phone call from his brother back home asking for some money to buy rice for the family to eat. The phone call left him perplexed.
I was shocked. I'm like, we never had to buy rice, so why do we have to buy rice now? He said, because they didn't farm for two seasons. So like from the last season that they farmed, they were able to live on that for almost a year. It was when they called and said because they didn't farm for two seasons. And then I tried to find out why. And initially, it was about the machines, about the irrigation machine, and then about the tractor.
Before that phone call, Musa would send money home for everything except rice or any other feeding needs because those were always available in abundance. In the ensuing months, he decided to quit his $85,000 per annum job in the U.S. as an engineer at Verizon Wireless to return to the Gambia and go into rice farming to help his family and revive his father's legacy.
I was really making money as an engineer for Verizon Wireless. I lived the American dream because I had everything I needed in America, had a good job, a wife, kids, and my mother all live with me in the U.S. But then thinking about it, this call is more important than any other call. And I had to answer to this call. So this is why I decided I had to come home, leave the job, leave my family back there, trying to look at the impact, I mean, the social impact that I'm going to make having to come home, trying to introduce rice farming. That's going to be easier, less labor intensive, and more profitable.
When Musa informed his friends in the U.S. about his plan, most told him he was crazy.
They didn't believe me. They thought because of the opportunity I have in the U.S., it's not ideal for me to come back here to be a farmer. Some are saying I'm mentally insane.
Musa is on the path to prove his friends wrong. Having already set up Maruo Farms Limited, he is pursuing his dream to revolutionize rice production in the Gambia. In January, his first batch of rice went into the market and instantly won the hearts of the Gambian rice consumers. Musa's plan is to grow rice across the country and become the biggest supplier of rice in the Gambia. Reporting for VOA, I'm Sherif Bojang Jr. in Banjul.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, 25 years ago, the international community convened in an attempt to create a world where men and women are equal. A discussion on women's equality on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Setting aside the questionable notion that black and brown people are less likely to be infected by the coronavirus pandemic, African governments and people must observe what is happening around the world and see how other governments and people are coping with this pandemic. It is true that at the present time, the incidence of the virus in Africa is very low. But so it is in Latin America and in the Caribbean. So this should not prevent governments and people to look and see, for example, how China handled the situation. When this virus broke out initially, China used what was termed a draconian measure to lock down a city of 11 million Wuhan and restrict movement of people, closing factories, closing schools. Now we know that these were good measures, and today the incidence of the virus is receding in China. We also see what happened in South Korea. South Korea present another model. When South Korea was confronted with the spread of this virus, they embarked on massive testing of the population to determine who has or does not have the virus. Even though in the end, the number of affected South Koreans was small, at least the government was able to have a good picture on how best it could tackle the situation. Outside of China and South Korea, many Western countries felt these were draconian measures that they could not accept in a democratic situation. And they were slow to adopt these measures. But Italy presented another model of what slowness could entail. When it became very difficult to stop the spread of the virus in Italy, the government initially locked down northern Italy. But still, social movement continued and the spread of the virus continued. So the government was obliged to lock down the entire country of Italy, and is still locked down. And now they are trying to see how best they can control the virus. It is because of the high incidence of the virus in Italy in particular that WHO announced last week that Europe is now the epicenter of the virus and no longer China. We have seen also that Spain is encountering difficulties, yet many European governments are working on the plan of containment and mitigation, but many predict that they may have to move more towards the Italian model. The United States present a different situation. The U.S. is a complex society, and controlling it has proved to be difficult. It is only in recent days that the federal government has started working with the state governments to handle the situation of the spread of the virus. And schools have been closed, sports are being postponed. And these are things are just at the beginning. And many believe things will get worse before they get better. What is happening in Tehran will be more similar to what may happen in Africa. Tehran or Iran has been under a campaign of maximum military and economic pressure. And because of that, its economy is at a very low ebb and is not in the position to cope with the virus. This may account for the fact that it is increasing very high in Tehran. Iran has just requested the IMF for a loan of $11 billion to be able to cope with this virus. But the government is worried that the U.S. might use its veto power in the IMF to block it. Just a few days ago, President Ping of China committed China to help Iran deal with the issue of the virus. Now, in Africa, we said there are some numbers of the incidents, but mostly in northern Africa near the Mediterranean. That is understandable because it's near to Europe. But governments should embark on massive civic education to let the people understand what would happen if, in any event, the virus should spread in the African continent. This may be the time when perhaps mythology may be better than reality, and hopefully the African continent might be spared this pandemic. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Down I end up.
I want to love you for life.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Producer Douglas Mpuga, we say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, one who eats alone cannot describe the taste of the food to others. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.